Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Join the millions of players around the world and bring in the new year with the all-time favorite classic match three game, Candy Crush Saga. It's fun to play and challenging to master, with thousands of levels to switch and match your way through. Get that sweet feeling this new year with Candy Crush Saga. Download it now from the App Store or Google Play for free.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and in the early hours of Friday, the 10th of January, these are our main stories. US reports say a Ukrainian passenger plane that crashed in Iran was shot down by an anti-aircraft missile system. Queen Elizabeth and other senior members of the British royal family are said to be working with Prince Harry and his wife Meghan as they step back from royal duties. And how satellites in the night sky are causing problems for astronomers. Also in this podcast,
we wanted to be really quick to react to this news that has gone worldwide already.
How London's famous Madame Tussauds Waxwork Museum reacted to the royal news. We begin this podcast with the mystery of how the Ukraine International Airlines flight crashed near Tehran Airport early on Wednesday morning, killing all 176 people on board. Today, a senior Ukrainian security official volunteered four possible theories for what might have happened, including one that is now crystallising with many commentators as the most likely explanation, that it was brought down by a surface-to-air missile. The passengers on the plane included more than 60 Canadians, many of them members of the country's large Iranian community. Earlier, Canada's Prime Minister Justin Trudeau made this announcement.
We have intelligence from multiple sources, including our allies and our own intelligence. The evidence indicates that the plane was shot down by an Iranian surface-to-air missile. This may well have been unintentional. This new information reinforces the need for a thorough investigation into this matter.
Our correspondent Neda Taufik is in Toronto.
I think it's interesting that on Wednesday, the Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, wouldn't rule out a missile strike was the cause of the accident. And today he said that the government's preliminary conclusions based on the available evidence was clear enough to share with Canadians. He didn't go into what that evidence was, but clearly the Canadians are in agreement with the U.S. intelligence officials who believe that the plane was most likely unintentionally brought down by Iranian surface-to-air missiles. Now, we have reports that the U.S. had detected radar and then satellite heat signals from the two missiles. We didn't get that kind of detail from the Prime Minister, but he said this was the reason a credible, thorough investigation was needed. He is still pressing for Canada to have access to the crash site, and he said that Iran was seemingly open to that, that they did get signals that they would be okay with Canadians involved, and also getting Canadian consular officials' visas to get to Turkey to assist with the repatriation of Canadian nationals there.
Yes, and he, as you said, talked about this possibly being accidental, unintentional. There's been a statement from Downing Street here in London with words to a similar effect. Are the Canadians, are others being careful to frame it in that way?
Yeah, absolutely. And a number of times during this press conference, the Prime Minister was asked, could he definitively say that this was, in fact, an accident? He said that he couldn't be sure of anything. And that's why, again, he was calling for a credible investigation. He, you know, pointed out the fact that the cause of this will cause more grief for the many Iranian Canadians here who suffered from this. Of course, there was 138 people who were on their way to Toronto, 63 Canadians, others who were international students who were studying here. So he is well aware when he gives these statements that these are people wanting answers, at the same time still very much mourning the loss of loved ones.
Neda Taufik in Toronto. G.R. Goll works for the BBC's Persian service. He told James Kumarasamy how the Iranian government has been reacting to the accusations.
They say they believe the plane had an engine failure. She was on her way back to the airport, But the pilots, they didn't send any emergency signals to the airport. And they believe that was the cause of the crash. And even some media close the Iranian government, they say, oh, this is a conspiracy spread by anti-revolutionary media. We hear that kind of rhetoric coming out from Tehran.
And anything on the level of cooperation they're going to give to the Canadians, the Ukrainians?
Well, the Iranian investigator, they said they have found the data recorders, the black boxes, but they said they are not willing to hand it over to American, which Boeing, the company, is based there. We have to wait and see how much pressure could apply on Iran and make them to hand it over. But also, having in mind this, this thing happened just few hours after Iran fired 23 missiles, ballistic missiles, from Iran to American bases in Iraq. There was a rumor at the time maybe one of these missiles have hit the plane, but that was ruled out because the missiles were fired from the western Iran, from Kermanshah, the province of Kermanshah, which is close to Iranian border with Iraq. It's 500 kilometers far from Tehran. But we heard from one eyewitness. He was a soldier. He said he was in one of those military barracks. He said they have seen three missiles were fired at the plane, one hit. But at the time yesterday, we really couldn't confirm this because it was too difficult for us. But we were hearing this kind of voices from Iran that it may have hit by an anti-missile aircraft, because don't forget, the Iranian anti-missile system, they were on highest alert. Possibly they were expecting some sort of retaliation by American. Also, we were hearing a lot of rumors on the media that American fighter jets have taken off from United Arab Emirates toward Iran. So possibly if this happened, they may have mistaken for fighter jets.
And what about those who are on board the flight?
That's a very sad story, actually, if you look at the names of those people who have been killed, particularly those people who were Canadian. It seems to me most of them, they wanted to get out of the country before possible war between Iran and United States started. Even one of them tweeted before boarding the plane, say, pray for me. I hope before I leave the country, war doesn't start.
G.R. Gold from the BBC's Persian service. Now to a story that continues to gather steam, the decision by the Duke and Duchess of Sussex to take a step back from the royal family. The move by Harry and Meghan has been called everything from rogue royals to a right royal disaster and Mexit. So how's it playing out in the UK? Simon McCoy spoke to our royal correspondent Sarah Campbell at Buckingham Palace.
Well, that statement continues to make headlines around the world. I can tell you I'm surrounded by international news crews. There's no more official comment today from Buckingham Palace other than to wish Catherine, the Duchess of Cambridge, a happy 38th birthday. But after that initial terse statement last night, there is a sense that things are already moving on, if you like. And our understanding is now that sort of within the palace there is a willingness to make this work, not just for Harry and Meghan, but for the entire royal family. But it will be complicated. The financial aspects are particularly complicated because what has to be avoided is any suggestion of cashing in on the royal name, which has affected other members of the royal family in previous years. And there's no precedent for this, really, for such a high-profile member of the royal family to step back, to become part royal, part private. So there are still many, many things to be worked out, and that will take time.
Something that hasn't taken time. The British public deciding where they stand on this. Within hours, Madame Tussauds Wax Museum in central London moved their Harry and Meghan wax figures away from the rest of the royal family to the celebrity area. Their spokesperson, Claire Tracy, told us more.
We try to always make sure that we're mirroring what's happening on the world stage here in Madame Tussauds London. So waking up to this news with everyone else, we felt now was the time to reflect what's happening in the royal family within our attraction. You know, we live in a world where it's a very quick news agenda now. We always want to stay on top of what's happening in the celebrity and public profiles' lives and make sure that's reflected here. So that's what we were doing now. We wanted to be really quick to react to this news that has gone worldwide already.
And while the response here in the UK has been mixed, in Meghan's home country, the US, reaction has been more positive. Laura Podesta is from CBS News in New York and also spoke to Simon.
Megxit is trending on Twitter, and it's a decision that Americans are interested in. A lot of responses on social media are, of course, tongue-in-cheek, but Americans are looking at this also in a more serious way. We know that Prince Harry has spoken outwardly about his struggles with mental health. We all saw what happened to his mother and with the paparazzi. So there is a lot of understanding and sympathy for Meghan and Harry to want to leave the intense microscope of being a part of the British royal family and trying to carve out another way of life.
And a lot of speculation about what that life would entail, which of course she has acting to fall back on if she needs to do that. But what about Prince Harry? What are the suggestions about how they can make money over there?
Yeah, you mentioned Meghan with acting. A lot of Americans are obsessed, you could say, with the Netflix series The Crown. They're wondering if she'll be able to play herself in an upcoming episode. We also know that Meghan used to have a lifestyle blog, The Tig, that she might want to get back into writing in order to further monetize that. And some are speculating that they both could create a production company or create a production deal like the Obamas recently did with Netflix. Of course, Prince Harry has his own private inheritance from his mother, and Meghan reportedly made $450,000 a year working as an actress before she got married. So both are in a position to not have to rush into finding a job and will really have the opportunity to pick and choose what they want to do for work and, of course, take the time they need to establish their new charity, which they talked about in their Instagram post.
I was watching you a bit early. You suggested that Prince Harry could think about becoming an Uber driver.
Well, of course, on Twitter, there's lots of suggestions about what he could do. Open a restaurant, go to work like the rest of us, learn how to meal prep and do taxes, all the boring things that us commoners have to do.
Laura Podesta speaking to my colleague Simon McCoy. Now to a problem shining brightly in the night sky. Satellites, yes. Astronomers say that the communications devices orbiting the Earth are making the sky too bright and are interfering with the telescope's view of the sky. Meanwhile, the aerospace manufacturer SpaceX says it's committed to finding a solution to this. I asked our science correspondent, Jonathan Amos, how much of a problem the brightness of satellites is.
These particular satellites are very bright indeed. It just happens to be, I think, the way that these satellites are configured, what they're made of, the way that they fly, means that when they're released from the top of a rocket, they look extremely bright. I mean, they are much, much brighter than the brightest unnatural artificial objects that are in the sky currently. And, you know, when they come off the top of the rocket 60 at a time, they're like a great train of pearls, if you like, moving overhead. And that's deeply worried the astronomical community because they're looking at the sky and then all of a sudden these bright lights start crossing the field of their detectors.
And these satellites, they are important because they're going to bring internet to all sorts of parts of the world where at the moment it's difficult. But if it's going to cause these problems for astronomers, are there solutions out there to mean everyone can be happy?
Well, they hope so. It's not just that they're bright, it's the fact that there are so many of them. And also, it's not just SpaceX, so that there are other companies that want to get into the same game. So there's a company here in London called OneWeb. It won't launch as many satellites, about 650. But if you add that to the many thousand that SpaceX are launching, Jeff Bezos, the boss of Amazon, he's a bit of a space geek. He wants to do the same thing. And, you know, he has very deep pockets. And he's talking about thousands of satellites. So, you know, today, just to put this in context, today there are 2,000 operational satellites in orbit. In the space of just a few years, we are going to double, triple, quadruple. We are going to dramatically increase the number of objects in the sky. And when they catch the sun at dusk, at dawn, they look very bright indeed.
So there's only a limited time to sort this out?
SpaceX are launching these satellites at a rate of about 60 every couple of weeks. OneWeb will, from next month, start rolling out 30-odd every single month. So there is a very narrow window now to try and get this sorted out.
Jonathan Amos. Still to come in this podcast.
Some of our relationships could conceivably have a life expectancy of more than 80 years.
Why a quarter of couples in the UK don't live under the same roof. In China, there are reports that scientists have identified a new virus which could be from the same family which produced the deadly SARS strain. The new virus is said to have caused a mystery outbreak of pneumonia in the city of Wuhan. My colleague James Menendez has been hearing more from our East Asia regional editor Celia Hatton.
We have 59 cases at the moment reported in Wuhan. Seven of those cases are those people are said to be seriously ill. All of those people are in quarantine. We also have a further 21 in Hong Kong. And there's one person in South Korea who's being monitored who recently traveled from Wuhan. So this does appear to be spreading in some way.
And is the thinking that this is some kind of new virus that's emerged then?
Yeah, that's what the World Health Organization is saying, that a new virus has been identified. It's in the same family of viruses as SARS, which you had mentioned, which really spread across the world, 30 countries in 2003. SARS was particularly deadly among those who caught it. It caused 775 deaths in a really short span of time until it was contained. And that's really why the authorities are on alert because of this virus. It seems to be coming from the same type of source. So most of the people who have the virus in Wuhan were workers at a wet market. That's the kind of market that sells live birds and fish. And so many of those, and that's really how SARS came about as well. It was workers in a wet market. This kind of virus, the coronavirus, is the type of virus that can jump easily from animals to humans. And what the World Health Organization is saying now is that this virus can cause severe illness, but at the moment it doesn't seem to be easily transmissible between human to human, and that's giving them some pause for cheer a little bit.
But worries in particular because lots of people in China are going to be traveling. Is that right soon?
Yeah, that's right. So tomorrow is the official start of the Chinese New Year travel period. And this year, it's thought that there are going to be more journeys than ever before, around 3 billion individual journeys around the country ahead of Chinese New Year, around the Chinese New Year period. Chinese New Year's Eve is on January 24th. So really, this is the key time of the year when the health authorities do not want a new mystery virus to be circulating around. And it really is cause for concern because it's unclear whether the lessons from SARS from 2003 have really been absorbed by the Chinese authorities.
Our East Asia regional editor, Celia Hatton. Parts of northern India have been witnessing an unusually severe cold spell this winter. Over the past few weeks, cities have experienced record low temperatures with foggy conditions affecting air and road travel. The capital, Delhi, recently recorded its chilliest day in more than a century. Among the worst affected are thousands of homeless people who live on its streets. Praktisha Gildial reports from Delhi.
A cold winter night has set upon Delhi. It's slightly foggy and I have come to a small homeless settlement where kids are building an outdoor campfire. Desperate to keep warm, they are trying to survive one of the coldest winters that North India has seen in decades. Recently, Delhi recorded its lowest temperature in a century with a low of less than 3 degrees Celsius. India's homeless people are suffering the most, including large families with children. Ruksana Begum lives on the streets with a husband and 5 children. She describes her ordeal. We sleep under a plastic sheet. We have one mattress and one blanket to share amongst us. And my little one keeps getting sick because of the cold. We are poor people. Where can we go? Government-run shelters are overflowing because the space in them is just not enough for the city's 50 to 60,000 homeless people. I have come to one of Delhi's biggest homeless shelters run by the city government. People are queuing up to spend the night here to escape the cold weather outside. There are about 450 people here, some of them watching a movie on television, all huddled around mattresses and blankets provided to them. But it's still a struggle to keep warm. Unlike Western countries, buildings here don't have central heating, and people don't usually wear thick winter coats, making it harder to cope.
I have never felt so cold, ever before. I have been getting cough, cold and fever.
I have asthma, so I'm really suffering and not being able to work properly. I feel if I sleep outside on the streets, I will die. That's why I came to the shelter.
So why are there such few options for the homeless to survive the cold? Sunil Kumar Aledia is from the NGO Center for Holistic Development.
The government only wakes up to the crisis in winter. There is no concerted policy to protect the homeless from the cold. The lack of space in shelters is a huge problem. And the government hasn't even made an appeal to make sure that the homeless are brought to the shelter homes.
India is already seeing extreme weather in all seasons. This was also India's hottest decade on record, according to a government report. It's clear that India stands to be one of the countries most affected by climate change, given its huge population and poverty levels. Which means cities like Delhi will need to urgently find sustainable ways to protect its people from harsh weather conditions.
Pratisha Gildial reporting. They say that absence makes the heart grow fonder, and a new study here in the UK seems to show people testing that theory out, with more than 25% of adult couples now living apart. Lucy Beresford, author of Happy Relationships, told my colleague Tom Hagler why people in relationships might choose to live alone.
There are a variety of reasons. Financial often comes into play, but it can also be time of life, because a lot of people are now getting together much later in life, perhaps after a previous marriage or a bereavement, and their homes are already established. There are two people coming together who've already got properties of their own. And what we see increasingly is that there are more people who are living apart together and making it work for themselves. So instead of it being an obstacle, which is what a lot of us in our 20s thought when we got together and, you know, he lives in one flat and you live in another and you spend most of your social life plotting when you're going to see each other. Nowadays, people are actively choosing this arrangement.
So these are young couples. These aren't older couples deciding to move apart because it might improve their relationship somewhat.
Not necessarily. That's true. It's across the spectrum. But it is also people later in life who perhaps have decided that second time around, or maybe even third time around, if they're going to be in a long-term relationship with someone, they might do things slightly differently. So it could be in your 20s or 30s, but it also is people in their 50s and 60s. And I think we have to recognize, you know, if we're all going to live to this sort of fabled, I don't know, 110, 120, some of our relationships could conceivably have a life expectancy of more than 80 years. And being in the same property as your partner, as your loved one, for all that time, it's going to bring a very different set of problems. So it could very well be that this new way of operating is going to become the norm.
Is this a new phenomenon?
Well, I would argue not, in the sense that for several generations, you will have had people who have got together, maybe in their teens, their 20s, their 30s, and they will have had one property and the other people would have had another. They might, you know, sharing a flat or maybe even still living with their parents. So the idea of being in a committed relationship but not living together isn't necessarily unusual.
Right. And relationships where the couples don't live together, do they lead to a longer, happier relationship or a shorter relationship? What's the research on that?
My theory is that when you're living apart, you have the opportunity to develop something called individuation, which is where you're in a committed relationship, but you don't collapse in on each other. You don't become codependent on each other, but you're able to nourish and focus on things that are very important in your life and develop a certain resilience. All I would draw attention to is that there are some quite interesting life skills that we develop when we do end up living with someone. And those are also quite important, things around tolerance, around give and take, and also navigating the obstacles when things go wrong.
Psychotherapist and broadcaster Lucy Beresford. Now, if, like some of my colleagues, you occasionally go wary of the tedious task of toothbrushing, the world's biggest electronic show may have the answer. The event has been taking place this week in Las Vegas, and Zoe Kleinman is there playing with some of the thousands of items on display, including the 10-second toothbrush.
The vast conference halls here in Las Vegas are crammed with gadgets from around the globe, vying to catch the eye of both the world's media and the investors who roam the event. From the biggest brands to the smallest startups, CES is a melting pot of tech innovation. Some of it is more ambitious than others. So far this week, we've seen driverless cars, smart kitchen gadgets, a $60,000 television that can roll itself away into the ceiling, bikes that ride on water, and even a virtual reality toilet experience. One of my favourites was a 10-second toothbrush. So I'm in the French tech zone of Eureka Park here at CES, which is a sort of innovation station. And I'm with Benjamin Cohen from the firm Ybrush. This is a toothbrush that claims you can clean your teeth in 10 seconds. Hello, Benjamin.
Hi. Ybrush is a toothbrush with a handle which is able to provide sonic vibrations to a brush which is Y-shaped and very flexible, and it does exactly the same work as a standard toothbrush, but it brushes all your teeth at the same time instead of brushing your teeth one by one.
So if I can just sort of quickly describe how it works, it's like a sort of denture-shaped brush. You put toothpaste all the way around it, you clamp it between your jaws and you chew on it, and it times you for 10 seconds and it vibrates, and that's how your teeth get cleaned. It's taken you a little while to get to market, hasn't it?
Yes, in fact, we have started to pre-sale the product in 2018, and now the product is available from last month. But we have worked for 4 years in R&D to develop the product with dentists.
And what's wrong with the normal toothbrush?
With a normal toothbrush, people don't brush their teeth for 2 minutes. 2 minutes is the time recommended by dentists. So with our toothbrush, we brush the teeth more, but only in 10 seconds because it brushes all the teeth at the same time so that we can get better health.
How long does the battery last?
The brush lasts for 6 months. And when it's over, you only have to replace the brush by buying a new one, and the cost is only $30 or €25.
Who is your target market for this? Who are you aiming it at?
In fact, we have two target markets. The first one is children and their parents, and the second one is people with a lot of money who want to improve their health, but they don't have a lot of time to do that.
You've been using it for about 6 months. What did your dentist say about your teeth?
My dentist is very happy.
Guess he would say that. Benjamin Cohen from Ybrush, ending that report by Zoe Kleinman. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this edition or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.
I have a secret. I wore the wrong foundation for years. Then I discovered Il Makiage, the boldest new brand in beauty. With 20,000 five-star reviews and 50 shades of flawless coverage, their Woke Up Like This foundation is a bestseller for a reason. It's tough buying foundation online, but their Power Match quiz matched me perfectly. And with Try Before You Buy, you can try your shade free for 14 days. Take the quiz at ilmakiage.com/quiz. That's ilmakiage.com/quiz.